Hello and welcome to episode one of The Tech Bubble, the podcast that focuses on digital literacy and technology, all within the context, of course, of our own South Island School. The music that you just heard was composed by Jonathan Chung of 12B2. Thanks to Jonathan for that. It's a great intro to our show. I'm your host, Ian Williamson, and joining me today, we have no less than five digital leaders forming our digital head team all the way from 2016 through until the present day. First up on the show, we have Zaid Saeed, mastermind of the first ever ESF computer conference and currently studying at the University of California, Berkeley. Hi, Zaid.
Hi.
Second up, we have his co-leader from those first 2 years of the DLC, also involved in setting up the first ESF computer conference. And that is Shannon Hoy, who is studying at Barnard College, Columbia University. Good morning, Shannon.
Hey.
Okay, we've got two familiar faces, even though it's a podcast, so you can't see them. From our current year 13, that is Sam Bonnekamp, the founder of our coding club at South Island School. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
And we've got Karina Au, one of our head prefects and one of our most outstanding advocates of media literacy here at South Island School. Hi, Karina.
Hi.
And finally, we have Phoebe Lung, who is also the Baha'i house captain, one of our most outstanding mathematicians. So hi, Phoebe.
Hi.
So thanks very much for joining us all. What we're going to do to start with, I'd like to mention that we are currently recording the show on Zoom, which, I don't know, it seems to me quite a fitting reflection of the times that we're living in at the moment, and obviously the online learning that is going on worldwide at the moment. Perhaps maybe this is a good place actually to start. Zaid, if I could begin with you, what's been the impact for you with the coronavirus rather over at Berkeley?
Yeah, I think it's really been quite interesting because this isn't the first time we've had to deal with some sort of disruption to our learning. So pretty much the first semester I started at Berkeley, we actually had wildfires just around the state. So we had a few days off of school because of that. And then we had power outages the year before, just past this past fall. So we've had quite a bit of time, like a bit of a head start to deal with and develop some instructional resilience. So we've had a few classes on Zoom, so we sort of eased into it a bit. And we've, even though it's still very sort of novel, it's still pretty new, we've had a bit of time to adjust to sort of online learning.
So is Zoom the main platform for that, Zaid, or have there been any other instructional software that have been used by your lecturers?
I think the institution as a whole has pretty much adopted Zoom as the main platform for digital learning.
It seems to be that Zoom has, you know, kind of become incredibly popular worldwide, doesn't it, at the moment? I mean, you know, we as a school initially went down the line of thinking about the big blue button, which the advantage to that would have been that it would have been embedded within our platform. But it's also, you know, takes up a huge amount of storage space, you know, and with particularly given that videos are automatically recorded in the BBB. And it's one of the reasons why I think Zoom was preferable, because it simply works very, very easily. Although obviously there have been some articles written recently in things like I think it was the New York Times that suggested that, you know, that there are privacy concerns with Zoom as well. Maybe I could come back to that later on. Shannon, I know you're listening in here as well. What about for you with your learning? How's the coronavirus impacted things for you?
Yeah, like Berkeley and most schools, we've also completely transitioned to Zoom for remote learning. And I guess at its best, it's like really a monument to the potential of technology in reconfiguring our notions of accessibility in academia and the workplace. But I guess at its worst, the quality of lectures and discussion sections have really been compromised, particularly for my architecture studio-based classes. And yeah, I already feel that being in front of a screen all day is really starting to reflect in my health, and I can't even imagine how South Island and other schools have maintained online learning for so much of the last year.
Yeah, but it's been interesting seeing the reaction of you know, teachers or even former colleagues who are working in the UK, Shannon, who you know, are now, what, 2 weeks into this process? I imagine America is very similar, perhaps another week or so there. Yeah, I mean, in Hong Kong, we've been going at this now since the beginning of February. Yeah. So it kind of feels like we're past masters in this process.
It's crazy.
Well, I mean, I would add to that, Shannon, that it's been more than just, Zoom. I mean, you know, I think there have been a whole number of different pieces of software that have been used in the last couple of months. As you know, people like Larissa Curran, you know, who's a colleague of mine in the film and media department, has been championing things like Pear Deck, which has provided a more synchronous learning process. We'll come to Sam in a moment, but I know, Sam, you've enjoyed using that platform. We've had things like Screencastify, which enables kind of tutor, almost like tutorials to be constructed and sent out to the students in advance. I'm going to be using Parlay, which is a kind of Socratic seminar discussion software, in about 20 minutes or so once this podcast finishes with my Year 12 film students. So, you know, in some ways, I take your point, Shannon, that it's a pretty a horrible situation. But I think it's also led to a lot of experimentation, a lot of pedagogical change for practitioners around the world. Just coming on to the next question, you know, with regards to the experiences that you've had at Columbia and Zaid, I'd ask you the same question here. What have been the most exciting sort of technological opportunities that have been afforded to you, in moving into, you know, your university chapter of your life as opposed to being in secondary school? What sort of things have you been exposed to there?
Yeah, I mean, as an architecture student, I've been really, really excited about the use of 3D printing and computer-aided design and construction and their potential in humanitarian relief and affordable housing, especially in light of rising pressures from climate change and also, I guess, relevant in light of the coronavirus situation as well. And I've also been exploring the implications of VR, AR, and photogrammetry technologies on mainstream architecture representation. And in addition to like psychological research surrounding evolutionary cognition and social interaction with robotics. And Columbia has really offered me a lot of a really supportive community for my exposure to UI UX design and product management. And yeah, I think that there really is a future in mobilizing these developing technologies as agents of social inclusion and accountability and connectivity. And I guess again and again, we're really seeing like case studies of accessible interfaces mitigating loneliness amongst like aging populations, or like artificial intelligence being used to facilitate like the democratization of education. And like in many ways, our virtual experiences are really filling the gaps of our built environment. And that's really exciting to me as a designer. But just by being at a women's college, I've like had a lot of privilege to participate in programming and conversations about intersectionality in STEM and like the demand for women and people of color in technology-related industries. And yeah, I think it's really important that we're not only thinking about how to encourage people to enter the field, but also like equipping underrepresented communities with the resources to further deconstruct the glass ceiling of leadership.
Yeah, absolutely, Shannon. I mean, that kind of gap that exists in technology worldwide, and it's something that perhaps at South Island School we don't see as much of, and interesting as well, the points that you're making about artificial intelligence there. I'm just, reaching for one of the books that I've been reading at the moment by Stuart Russell, Human Compatible, as part of I've got about 20 books stacked on top of each other. I'm getting very bad for this, by the way. I tend to start a book and then kind of flip to another book. And I don't know if that's something to do with, you know, the way that we use technology nowadays, that we flip from, you know, one program to another, kind of multitasking very badly. And I think I do the same with reading at the moment. I was also going to mention there that we're about to launch a new app that actually the DLC has been exploring in the last couple of months, ESF Connect, which is an alumni, application. And it was really interesting to hear some of the things that you're talking about there, because I would imagine, when we'll come to Karina in a moment, who I know is going to, go off to university in London next year, and we'll be studying, you know, kind of new media technology and things like that. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the opportunities for networking that come through the ESF, not just through South Island, but by reaching out to other students within the ESF network as a whole, really, you know, have huge potential going forward. Zaid, what about from you? What have been some of the most interesting sort of technological opportunities for you in your first year or so at university?
Yeah, I think I've definitely been very privileged to, go to school in the Bay Area, right next to Silicon Valley. There's just so many opportunities to, get your hands dirty with technology, so close to, San Francisco and San Jose. And, so many of my peers have gotten the opportunity to, work not only, at school, but at the same time pursue internships or opportunities to work with technology companies in the Bay Area. But I think what's also really interesting, and Shannon highlighted this, really well, is that there's so much inequity in terms of the opportunities to these sort of things. So for example, in the Bay Area, you have, San Francisco and like these really, rich, wealthy, Silicon Valley suburbs and areas that have a lot of, great technological development. While at the same time, you have places like, East Oakland, which, is a completely different world where right next door to UC Berkeley, where a lot of people don't have those same opportunities. So it's been really, fascinating to see this huge divide in such a small, part of the world. But I think being so close to this place with so much opportunity has been really interesting. This past fall, I had the opportunity to join a human-centered design consulting group. And this past fall, I worked with YouTube, which is based in San Bruno, not too far away from Berkeley. And this spring, I'm working with Samsara, which is an Internet of Things enterprise company that works with warehouses and truck drivers on sort of integrating technology into this, industry, which, you might not think has a whole lot of innovation going on. So attending, school like UC Berkeley and being in the Bay Area has definitely connected me to a lot of opportunities, which I don't think I would have found in Hong Kong.
That sounds incredibly exciting. I mean, I've been watching a whole number of almost kind of video essays on smart cities at the moment and the connectivity and you're talking about the Internet of Things there. Just for some of the our listeners, it could be that some of the younger students in school have not necessarily heard of the Internet of Things, or they don't necessarily know what it means. Could you just give us a quick explanation of what the Internet of Things means for you, Zaid?
Sure, yeah. So, for me, when I first came across that term, I thought it was used to describe, connected, smart devices, within sort of more of a home network. So you might have speakers that connect to your phone that you can control, or maybe it's something more fancy, like a whole lighting system or heating, like a thermostat you can control with your phone. But I think there are a lot of applications for this, not only, in the home or in the car, but also in, enterprise and industrial environments. So, for example, one project I'm working on has truck drivers use Internet of Things devices to monitor their speed, their safety. So there are a lot of applications for like hardware devices that work in tandem with Bluetooth and internet-enabled devices.
Yeah, it's like when I hire a car now in the summer, Zay, whenever I'm on holiday, it's like, you need a degree in computer science just to be able to actually get into the car and understand what it's going to do with it. I'm just going to sort of bring in some of the other guests now. So I'm going to sort of suggest something to us all. If we go back in time a little bit, you've all been part of the DLC. And if we turn the clock back, well, 4 years ago when this all started for you, and even before that, because Sam, you used to come up into D82, I would say probably when you were in year 7 and 8, and we used to chat about digital literacy back then. But clearly a lot has happened to the DLC. So starting with Sam and then perhaps Karina, if you can chip in as well. What do you think has been the single most important contribution that you've made to the DLC during your time? What have been the big developments?
Oof, that's a hard question, I think. My single biggest contribution, I think that's hard to say because a lot of the things that we've done over the past couple of years have been extremely like groundbreaking. Like our esports thing that we worked on for quite a while. That was like the first inter-house esports in any school, as far as I know, in Hong Kong at least. And although it didn't work perfectly, it was still completely new and completely like, yeah, it's probably one of the biggest things I've done in a long while, and especially in the DLC. But then also the coding club, which although it wasn't as revolutionary, is still a fantastic step in the right direction to kind of encompass programming and general computer literacy at school.
Yeah, I mean, I think the coding club has been huge, hasn't it? And that's not to downplay the significance of the esports as well. But I think that, it's quite unfortunate. I think one of the downsides of the current situation that we're in is that obviously people are glued to their computer screens. You know, Shannon, you alluded to this, for huge amounts of time. And as a result of that, I think anything that's then going to encourage more online participation than is already happening is you know, almost certainly, you know, going to be problematic. But that doesn't mean to say that there couldn't be a future for esports. And in fact, that may well be a topic of conversation for a DLC podcast, you know, as we go forward. But I think the coding club, Sam, especially, has started to create a culture. Just before we started the show, I was talking to Shannon and Zaid about the culture of coding that's now starting in school, which I know Phoebe's going to come in on in a few moments' time. But I don't think that existed at South Island School 2 or 3 years ago. And I think has been largely down to, you know, people like yourself, Sam, for putting that on. What about you, Karina? What do you think have been some of the kind of most significant developments from your perspective?
I think for me, I'd just say that the, like, my main kind of legacy at SIS, especially with the DLC, would be the establishment of the council as part of the four major councils within the school community. As it was very rightly said, we kind of started off in 2016. And I think as Sam and I kind of took leadership for the DLC, we were able to kind of connect the DLC with the student body. And I think this was especially successful as I tried to make the best use of my connections, whether it be working with the head prefect team to kind of ensure that the DLC joins this alliance called the Mega Council, involving the other councils at SIS, and setting up the social media accounts to ensure that we're rightly connected with the student body, and just basically set the kind of base into connecting with the student body. And of course, although I did take this first step for the council, it was definitely the help or the support of the entire council that ensured a kind of successful debut of our council.
And I do think, Karina, your like connections to the other people, and you're kind of like, because you're kind of known around school, so I definitely think that you were instrumental in kind of making us legitimate as a group.
Yeah, thank you.
I definitely agree with that, Karina. And I think what it's really shown is something of the kind of political processes that are often involved in going from, you know, a sort of hatchling idea that kind of starts to develop and then becomes something that is an integral part of the school, to the point that this year for the leadership team interviews, I know that the key positions of representation in the DLC is part of that process. And really, you're talking about 4 years that it's gone from, you know, suggesting the idea and having a small group of interested students to now, what, 30, 40 students in the DLC itself and an actual council. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well done to you, Karina. In fact, to both of you for driving that forward. What about, just going back to Shannon and Zaid for a moment. So from your perspectives, do you think that it was the ESF Computer Conference, which was, you know, the legacy that you left from your 2 years administering the DLC?
Yeah, I think definitely the ESF Computing Conference was pretty big in terms of leaving like a lasting community centered around technology. You know, I tried it a few times. You know, I had a coding club back in year 9, which, you know, I'm really happy to see Sam restart. And I think the ESF Computing Conference was definitely like that lasting impact that, you know, I really would have loved to see if I was like year 7, year 8, or even, you know, year 13 at SIS, just to be part of a digital community like that would be really amazing.
I think what that did was as well, I mean, because South Island was not associated particularly with coding at that time, it sort of put us on the map, didn't it? I mean, you know, with KG5 having such a robust you know, coding program, and also the likes of Island School, you know, with that sort of expertise in their teaching, I think that what it's done is in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just ask Phoebe for a second, because I know you've got some quite strong opinions on this with regards to what's happening right now with regards to technology. So I know you wanted to talk a little bit about computer science. So Phoebe, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the school's recently just implemented a computer science GCSE, And I understand that a lot of like the younger students are really interested in this program, and I believe it's from like the four of your works. Like, you guys have pushed DLC into such a great position that everyone would are interested to join the computer science. And even from like the young age, like the year 7 to year 9, like I understand my brother's in year 7 and he's already really interested in computer science. And I know that Mr. Walsh will also has a robotics unit in his physics class. And for the science club I'm leading right now with a few of my friends, we also did add a few robotics lessons so they can get a head start, or like they can try coding a bit.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the demand for computer science, and I know certainly Fran Crouch would sort of support me in what I'm about to say here, has come as much from the students and the parents as it has from staff. I mean, I think there's always been a core 5-10 teachers in the school who are very passionate about making sure that we have this kind of robust curriculum in place. And that's definitely going to happen with computer science coming in at GCSE level. But it's definitely come from the parents as much as anybody else. You know, they want to see this as part of the curriculum. We're actually joined by Justin Mann, who is our other digital leader currently in year 12 as well. We've just let him out of his dungeon where we make him edit, you know, for 24 hours a day. But we thought we'd let him see the light of day for a second. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, sorry I'm late.
That's okay, Justin. Better late than never. We're glad to have you here. So, Justin, in terms of from your perspective, obviously we're beginning to focus more on emerging technologies as part of the DLC. And that's been something that we've been trying to discuss more in recent meetings. So, you know, what excites you the most about the kind of current technological trends that we've got happening, either in society or indeed in what's going on at our own school?
Frankly, what excites me is something that's been around for quite some time. So on Reddit, I see a lot of news articles about how people in the States, like, they're out to respirators, and you have, like, individuals and, like, small businesses with, like, 3D printers on the side, and they're printing respirators for, like, hospitals and, like, the country to use. And I just feel like, well, the school has 3D printers, right? So is there something that we could be doing for Hong Kong or anything?
Now that you mention it, there was this thing recently that happened in Germany that was organized. I think this was massive. It was organized over the course of 3 days. It was called Via versus Virus, which basically means us versus virus. And it's basically a hackathon where people would create ideas and create proof of concepts over a 48-hour period. And they would then submit it, and then at the end of the 48-hour period, it would then be voted on which projects would get funding and whatnot. And 400,000 people joined, and the thing was organized in 3 days. It was crazy. But the point is, this program that was done also partly by the German government was to basically crowdfund ideas and labor to create something for people who are suffering under the virus. And that's definitely something that we could do as well. We don't have to limit ourselves to just 3D printing. We could say, hey, if there's any idea that you want to do, submit it or something like that. Like, I thought that was really cool.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, the Mercedes Formula One Grand Prix team have got involved, haven't they? So, you know, some very unusual sources have been finding sort of technological solutions to problems that have been going on. I know they've been supporting things back in the UK at the moment. I mean, Shannon, you alluded to this earlier on as one of your points that, you know, you've had a fair bit of exposure to, 3D printers, et cetera, mm-hmm. over, you know, in America at the moment. I mean, what sort of projects have you had the chance to work on there?
Well, I guess most recently I did a photogrammetry scan of the Grand Central Terminal, and we were able to work with Unity and Rhino and basically develop this like Android application that allowed us to kind of augment a projection of like the Grand Central Terminal interior on a 3D printed model. And I don't know, I guess like I just thought that there's so much potential for us to really rethink, like, as architects, how we perceive space and how we can in turn like represent our ideas to clients and other stakeholders. And yeah, I think that's really empowering for me as someone who is interested not only in like the built environment, but the virtual realm.
It's really interesting to hear you say that, Shannon. I mean, one of the future programs that we're planning as part of the podcast, so a little plug coming in here, the fact that we would like to try and produce something about the future of work. And it seems that some of the conversations that we've had today certainly lead into that. And I know Chloe Lau, one of the other members of the DLC, is very keen to get the alumni involved in that process. I suppose to generate some energy and excitement in our own school community about the possibilities that are out there, because it's such a fast changing environment for the world, for all of us at the moment, as we start to engage with that. I'm just gonna to sort of finish off, I'd like to kind of present a kind of hypothetical for you all. I'd like to imagine that we go forward in time. Let's hope by the time we reach August 2020, incidentally, that the world has moved on a little bit, things have improved, the virus spike has dropped down considerably, and let's imagine that we are back in school for a start. But imagine it's the beginning of the year and it's the first DLC meeting of the 2020-21 year. So what I'd like you to perhaps explain to me would be, what do you think the technological priorities should be for the year ahead? Sam, I know you're never short of an idea or two. What do you think would be for you? It's the beginning of the next academic year. Imagine that you're still there. Maybe you will be, Sam. We'll invite you in as a guest.
Probably.
What do you think your priorities would be?
Oh, that's a tough question, because there's always so much to do. But I think I'd work on further kind of integrating technology into the regular school curriculum, especially at the younger years, 7 through 9 specifically, whether that be programming, digital literacy, but also just things like teaching about privacy or how to distinguish between real and fake news, or how to, when you read an article online, how to make sure that it's correct and not being lied to, and that kind of stuff. Just general knowledge of how to use the internet.
That was a very, very good segue, by the way, Sam. You probably didn't realize that, but that's probably going to be the focus of episode 2. So there we go.
Great.
2 plugs in one episode. That's not bad, is it? Karina, what about you?
I think out of all the initiatives that we've done, I think I'd really want to prioritize our links with QES and Bradbury. Like, generally speaking, I'm quite keen on kind of spreading this idea of digital literacy and media literacy, as Mr. Williamson very rightly mentioned at the beginning. And I think that we've made such a great start, and I really want to be able to maintain this kind of culture, because not only is this a great opportunity to ensure that the younger years, like in primary school, have the skills necessary, and then they can integrate very nicely into kind of South Island School with the digital skills. I think it's also a very great opportunity for DLC members themselves to kind of gain the kind of confidence and be able to teach and work with these younger students as well. So it's kind of like a win-win situation that I think would be really great to maintain.
From what I've noticed from going down to Bradbury and QBS is that all the students there that kind of took part in the whole digital leaders thing, or the Bradbury and QBS students, are always so passionate. Like, they're always so really inactive, and I'm not sure if it's just because of their age or not, but if we can kind of kindle that passion early on in like year 5, year 6, and then they can bring it onto the DLC in year 7, 8, and 9, I think we can make the DLCs, or just the school in general, a lot more energetic.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I think you're absolutely right, Sam. And don't forget, I think one of the areas of development is that, we've got a really strong DLC from years 10 through to 13. I think we have, a sprinkling of students in year 9, but we don't really have much representation in Bohemia House. And I think that's a bit of a missed opportunity to really be, I suppose, inclusive and make sure that we represent the whole school community. So getting those kids coming out of not just those two schools, but perhaps also expanding this to the Peak as well, where we get, some of our intake from, and making sure that those students who are passionate about digital technology are with us from year 7 onwards. Phoebe, Justin, anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Sam and Karina. I think one of our most important initiatives right now is really like connecting with the Bradbury and QBS. And I understand like towards the end of the last term, we started helping them make their own like digital leaders council as well within the group. And they were also like very passionate, and they were keen to like also lead on this digital in their own school.
I think that with that, you know, up until now, I think we've concentrated a lot on cyber safety issues. But I think also, don't forget that you guys all have, you know, outstanding technological skills. And I think from the teacher's perspective down in Quarry Bay or at Bradbury, I think that you've also got the chance there. Live barking in the background, everybody. My dog made it onto the show. I knew he would eventually. I think the teachers would really benefit from the support that students can bring, you know, where we're not just talking to them about cyber safety issues, but we're also, you know, students are going down and lending a hand and getting students skilled up before they even begin secondary school. I think that's also very important going forward. I think that's just about all that we've got time for today, guys, but I'd like to thank my my six guests. We went from five to six during the show. As a final plug, episode 2 is coming soon and is going to focus on the crucially important relationship between well-being and technology, which is obviously a very hot topic right at the moment, given the demands of screen time demanded by online learning. If you have any thoughts, questions, or feedback, then please write to digitalleaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. Thanks for listening.